Porsche, 70 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
For the next few minutes, we're going to be delving into the remarkable life and, to some extent, mystery-shrouded life of one of the legendary athletes of the 20th century, an amazing woman by the name of Alice Marble. And during the height of her career in the late 1930s, she was without a doubt both the finest and the most famous woman tennis player in the world. In fact, perhaps at the height of her powers, she was more famous than any other tennis player in the world. But there is much more to Alice Marble's life than just her prowess on the tennis court, which is the reason why the new book by Robert Weintraub is so fascinating. It is titled The Divine Miss Marble, A Life of Tennis, Fame, and Mystery. And the book is published by Dutton, and we have a few minutes to speak with Robert Weintraub about his book and about the experience of trying to probe into some of the mysteries that have long surrounded the figure of Alice Marble. Robert Weintraub, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So tell us what you knew about Alice Marble ahead of undertaking this project. And what did you know at that point in terms of the questions that surrounded her?
Well, I knew probably as much as most of your listeners know about her, which is very little, to be totally honest. I knew the name, and that was about it. I knew she was a star tennis player from the distant past, and not much more about her. And then I started to delve into her life, and it was just one extraordinary occurrence after another. You mentioned that she was a great player. She was so much more than that, of course, but just to start with her on-court achievements, there was really two eras, the pre-Alice Marble era and then the post-Alice Marble era. And the first was when players mainly hit from the baseline and wore calf-length skirts and were coquettish, and it was a very dainty game, I guess you'd say, and Alice came along, and she was a tornado on the court of physical power and speed, and she wore shorts, which was a scandal when she first appeared on the court with her legs bare, but pretty soon everybody realized it was a major advantage and followed suit, and of course, she looked great wearing them, so she became very, very popular just for her physical appearance for a short time, and then when she started winning championships, she became even more popular. And she was laid up with various amounts of travails over her life. And the first main one in terms of tennis was she lost 2 years of her burgeoning career to tuberculosis. And she was in a sanitarium laid up for months at a time. And she came back from that to win the U.S. Nationals, what we call today the U.S. Open in New York, in 1936, and really became a superstar at that point, and went on to win 18 total titles in majors, including doubles. And then at the height of her power, of course, World War II came along and really put the curtain down on what otherwise would have been a career that we would know about even to this day. She would have won quite a bit more championships had she been able to play, but the war ended her career, but it allowed her to pivot in many different directions, which she already had started to do, and it in some ways made her even more famous, and as we'll get to, also brought up some mysteries about her life that I got to delve into.
One of the things we should say about her, the early part of her life, is that there is a real shift between where she was born and first grew up, and then where her family moved. And this marked a drastic shift in sort of what her daily life would be, and in a sense really helps point the direction of who she was ultimately going to become.
Yeah, she was born in the mountains along the California-Nevada border, the Sierra Range there. And when she was still a child, the family moved to San Francisco, and this became, you know, sort of her playground. Unfortunately, she was hit. Her father passed away in the aftermath of another pandemic, the 1918-19 Spanish flu pandemic. So there's a little tie-in there with what we're going through today. And she, you know, the family really fell on hard times. They had very little money, and Alice wound up, you know, making her way just based on her athletic prowess. And she wound up playing tennis at the Golden Gate Park, which soon was, you know, topped by the Golden Gate Bridge. But when she started playing, there was no bridge quite yet. And she, you know, it really helped her in her career. It was a hard scrabble way to learn the game, and most people who played, you know, competitive championship tennis came up through the rich country club, you know, sort of elite settings. And she came up the exact opposite way. And that really helped her when it came time to play against the top level competition. She, because of the way, you know, she had to kind of battle through just her learning of the game and the way that she, you know, started to play on cement courts with cracks and weather-beaten, you know, area that she did, she really had an advantage when it came time to play against some of the other people who weren't quite as tough as she was when it came to that. So she was, you know, came out of California, which was certainly not the epicenter of sporting prowess as it is now, and she had a lot to overcome in that sense too. But true to Alice's life, she overcame it and became the champion that she was.
One point of kind of delicious irony is you tell us that I believe it was her gifted athletic brother, Dan, who introduced her to tennis. And one of the reasons he did so was because Alice was so good at this plethora of other sports, even baseball. And but Dan regarded tennis as something that could be a little more sort of properly ladylike and maybe more appropriate. Little did he have any way of knowing that there would be nothing ladylike at all about the way she ultimately played the game.
Yes, it is ironic. As you say, she was such a baseball fan and player that she was really kind of the mascot of the local minor league team in San Francisco, who was at the time a very, you know, high-level team before the majors expanded out west. The San Francisco Seals, they made her, you know, kind of their unofficial mascot when Alice was only 12 or 13, and she, you know, had a rifle arm and was one of the best pitchers, even pitched for her high school team on the boys team, and excelled at pretty much every sport she ever took up. And tennis, as you say, was introduced to her as a way not only to be more ladylike, but I think, you know, as a sport that she could, you know, follow and achieve some level of fame, unlike baseball or basketball in those days, you know, that those were closed sports to women, and something that she could play well on into her later life as well. So it was a wise move by her brother, but I think Alice was already kind of got that drift herself as well, and had realized that tennis was her way out of the streets, so to speak.
Of course, the single person who has more than anything to do with Alice Marble's rise to greatness as a tennis player is her immortal coach, Eleanor Tennant, or Teach Tennant, who unfortunately is a largely forgotten figure. And I should mention just parenthetically that before I was able to access a copy of your book and I was just reading up on Alice Marble, I looked her up on Wikipedia. Of course, that's the place a lot of people start. And Teach Tennant is not even mentioned in the Wikipedia article about Alice Marble, and that is such an injustice. I'm glad that in your book you spend plenty of time talking about this woman and about their very close and often complicated relationship. Tell us about Teach Tennant, and in particular, how she was, in some ways at least, something like Alice Marble.
Yeah, they really had a lot in common. Tennant was also from San Francisco and came up really from nothing and used tennis as a way to increase her, you know, her wealth in life. She became a teacher, kind of talked her way into becoming the tennis pro at the old Beverly Hills Hotel. and through that became a teacher of the, you know, rich and famous in the Hollywood colony, the old Hollywood stars, including Carol Lombard, who gave her the nickname Teach, Clark Gable, Errol Flynn, Marlena Dietrich. I mean, just bold-faced names that are still obviously well-known today. And through them, you know, Alice, by proxy, became very close with a lot of them, especially Carol Lombard, who they regarded each other as sisters. And Eleanor was a very unusual woman. She had a very unusual way of speaking, her own kind of patois. And she, more than anything else, wanted to take a star, a player of raw material who came from somewhat similar background as her, basically nothing, and, you know, kind of mold this champion in Eliza Doolittle form. And Alice was that player. And the two of them had a, you know, very, very close. They were joined at the hip, basically, for about the entire decade of the 30s and into the 40s. And it was this Svengali kind of puppet sort of relationship for a long time. When Alice was laid up in the sanitarium, Eleanor paid all her bills. And from then on, Alice was basically in hock to Eleanor. And she worked the entire rest of her life almost to pay her off. And the two of them were certainly known to be very, very, very close, and most people assumed lovers. They always denied it, but under the surface, there was no question that they were certainly in love and had that sort of special bond that is almost closer than love between a coach and an athlete who achieved this rarest of amazing, you know, get to the very height of their chosen profession. And, you know, as you would expect from a relationship that was so close, the two of them then had a very passionate and volatile sort of breaking up, if you will, and came apart during the war over several issues. But Alice mainly felt it was time that she stepped off on her own and lived her own life rather than constantly doing whatever Eleanor Tennant told her to do. But it was certainly a profitable and fruitful relationship before that, and the two of them made history in all kinds of ways.
You've already touched on the fact that one of the most remarkable aspects of what Alice Marble managed to achieve as a tennis player is that it involved an absolutely incredible comeback from a very serious bout with tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is, of course, one of those things where most of us have heard the name but really don't understand what it means. Just briefly, explain how seriously ill Alice Marble was and just how remarkable her comeback from tuberculosis turned out to be.
Yeah, it really got started the year before when she was forced by the kind of tyrant head of the USTA at the time, a man named Julian Myrick, to qualify for the forerunner of, you know, the international competition she would be involved in to play. Alice was forced to play four matches in the same day in 110-degree temperatures in New York. So she collapsed almost immediately after that, and from then on had felt, you know, very poorly for the next few months. Then she went to France and collapsed on the clay courts there at the Roland Garros Stadium. And she was diagnosed shortly afterward with tuberculosis, which is, at the time, you know, if not a death sentence, pretty close to it. The lungs were certainly affected badly, and, you know, even if she survived, she was told straight away her tennis career, her sporting career was over. Nobody ever came back from a disease of the lungs like that. You know, we see sort of echoes of it now with the COVID-19. Even if you survive, there's obviously damage to the lungs, and nobody really knows what the long-term effects will be, even of fine-tuned athletes getting it. So you can imagine in the 30s, with a woman player who is still very young, only 21, Alice was essentially told that her tennis career, which was so promising, was over almost straight away. And she refused to take no for an answer and got better. And Eleanor kind of broke her out of the sanitarium. And the two of them took on what was, at the time, an unusually forward-thinking physical training program, something you would more closely see today, involving, you know, lifting weights and jumping rope and cardiovascular fitness, things that we take for granted now, obviously, but at the time, for a woman especially, were very unusual. And Alice, being Alice, she clawed her way right back to the top of the sport. And 2 years later, after collapsing on the grounds of the stadium in Paris, took the championship in Forest Hills, New York, the U.S. Nationals. And it was really an extraordinary event and catapulted her to superstar, and even beyond just what winning the tournament would have done. She became, you know, an incredible comeback story in the eyes of the nation, and everybody saw her as somebody who, you know, kind of overcame not just her own physical travails, but the depression that was crushing the country at the time. And she was held up as a kind of an exemplar of somebody who, you know, refused to lose, to use a cliche.
Right. She, of course, achieves the pinnacle of success in her sport in 1939 with great wins at both the U.S. Open and Wimbledon, and again wins the U.S. Open in 1940, although by that point, thanks to World War II, there is no Wimbledon championship for her to win, and indeed, amateur tennis all but vanishes during the war years. And Alice Marble has to, in a sense, rewrite who she is going to be. And although she plays professional tennis for a short time, even those kind of activities are sharply curtailed by the advent of the Second World War. Explain to our listeners some of the questions that surround exactly what Alice Marble did during those World War II years. This in and of itself is so fascinating.
Yeah, well, at the end of her life, she wrote a memoir which detailed some of the things that she said happened to her, which included an engagement and secret marriage to a combat pilot who subsequently was shot down in the skies of Europe. As a result, she was then kind of motivated by vengeance to take on a mission asked of her to do by U.S. intelligence to go to Switzerland and look up a different former lover who was a Swiss banker and, you know, was working at laundering funds of the Nazis who were trying to, at that point, escape Germany and set up something for themselves in post-war life. And then she would gather the evidence, which would be used at Nuremberg against this banker, and she claims was shot in the back as a result of this chase away from this man's chateau by a Russian double agent who wanted the same material from her. Now, an incredible story, and how much of it has actually happened is certainly open to debate. I could prove very little of it actually happening to the point where it occurs that she did marry or at least have an affair with a pilot during the war, but a different pilot, one not the one that she names in her memoir and not someone who was killed in the skies over Europe, and more than likely had an affair with an actual Nazi party member, not a banker who was working with the Nazis, but somebody who was actually one of the nefarious crew that pretty much started the war in Europe. And that's something you can imagine she would want to keep hidden for most of her life. And so, you know, you have to put it in context. When she wrote this, as I say, she made no money from her tennis greatness because of the amateur status of the sport during her time, and really lived on the margins for much of her life afterward. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, she was, you know, poor and living in California in the desert, kind of a kept figure by one of her former billionaire boyfriends. And, you know, she always wanted to give the fans what they wanted. That was her sort of, you know, kind of approach to life. She was very outgoing in that sense and always put on a show. And I think she embellished a little bit in her memoir just at the end to partially give, you know, the people what they wanted, to sell some extra books maybe, and to, you know, kind of remind people that who she was, and she was a somebody. And if it didn't exactly happen the way she put it down in the memoir, you know, she certainly had some interesting and incredible adventures during the war, and an incredible life as well. And, if, you know, memoir is in the eye of the beholder, as we've seen from many of those examples over the years. So I came in with my 50,000-foot view to sort of try and separate fact from fiction and be non-judgmental in the event of it at all as well.
I think you approach that question with great sensitivity, and it's also fun to read about some of the lengths to which you went in trying to really uncover definitive certainty about exactly what Alice Marble had done and when and where and so on. In our closing minute or so, help our listeners understand the scope of her celebrity at the height of her fame, particularly the kind of fame that she enjoyed among the Hollywood elite. I think it's sometimes a little hard for us to understand how such a thing was possible, but that, of course, was a very different era.
Yeah, and a lot of it stemmed from the fact that she wasn't paid for winning these tournaments. And so it was sort of assumed that she would need the kind of backing of the, you know, the elite in business and in entertainment and, you know, various other forms. And, you know, one of her huge benefactors in that sense was William Randolph Hearst, who invited her to stay at San Simeon whenever she wanted. And, you know, many other billionaires up and down the East Coast who would put her up when she was preparing for these tournaments. And, you know, through Eleanor knowing all these Hollywood jet setters and, you know, hanging out with them. It was ironic because at the same time, she couldn't afford to even, you know, open up her own bank account. She was sort of living in the, you know, the draft of all these incredible names. She had a Zelig-like existence in a lot of ways where she was sort of always at the right hand of some of these great names without ever really, you know, kind of gaining their lifelong, you know, fame and certainly none of the fortune that came with it. But she was extremely well-known at the time. She was, you know, Athlete of the Year, according to the AP, in both 1939 and 1940, and considered sort of beyond sports because of her relationships with these elites, especially the Hollywood elite, and because of, you know, her dazzling, not just beauty, but sort of all-American way about her. You know, she was considered sort of the it girl of the time and somebody who not only did everybody want to be around to be with, but to grow up to aspire to be like. She was, you know, certainly a very friendly type and somebody who, you know, never met a stranger and was very outgoing and had that California twinkle. And, you know, that really, especially during the Depression when there was so much to be, you know, depressed, if you will, about, she gave a lot of people a lot of hope and as a result became much more of an outsized figure than she might otherwise have been.
Right. You mentioned in your book that in 1977, when Wimbledon celebrated 100 years of champions, former champions were welcomed back to Wimbledon, although they had to pay their own way to get there. And Alice Marble actually had to turn to friends in order to raise enough money to make that trip. But I still remember the huge swell of applause when her name was announced and she walked out on that venerable court, one of the most honored women in the history of the game that she played so brilliantly. The book again is The Divine Miss Marble, A Life of Tennis, Fame, and Mystery, published by Dutton, the author Robert Weintraub. Robert Weintraub, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for giving the world such a fascinating book about the great Alice Marble. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two from the Morning Show Archives is coming up in just a moment. I remember with great fondness a past interview which I did with an author by the name of S.C. Gwynne. He and I spoke about a really marvelous book of his called Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the Most Powerful Indian Tribe in American History. When I saw that S.C. Gwynne had written something else that and that I had the opportunity to interview him, I was very, very excited. But then quite surprised to see what this newest book was titled. His newest book is called The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football. So a book nothing like that first book with which I first encountered Mr. Gwynne. This book, however, turns out to be quite interesting, every bit as interesting as that first book, especially if you are interested in the game of football and wonder how certain aspects of football have risen and fallen in prominence over the years, and in particular, the place of the forward pass, which once upon a time was all but unheard of in the playing of football. And now it is, in a sense, a staple of the game, but not always so. It turns out that one of the unsung heroes when it comes to the forward pass rising in prominence in football is a coach by the name of Hal Mumme. And this is a story about him and about the really difficult road that a lot of football coaches face, far more difficult than most of us ever realize. And it's also about what it means to be a visionary with a game as often tradition-bound as football can be. Once again, the name of this book is The Perfect Pass, American Genius and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner, and its author, S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, it's great to be with you again.
I'm glad we can do this. Tell us a little bit about your own connection to the game of football and what that has to do with the writing of this book.
Well, I'm just a good old-fashioned fan. You know, my hero when I was a kid was Johnny Unitas and Baltimore Colts. And, when I moved to Austin, Texas 20 years ago, I just totally got into the Big 12 conference. And, I'm not one of these completely kind of crazy fans, who flies into different cities to do the fantasy draft and things like that. But I'm pretty much just a fan. And the book came from I went out to do an article about a coach named Mike Leach for Texas Tech back in 2009, who had the hottest offense in America. His quarterbacks had led the NCAA 5 times out of 6 years or something, and nobody could stop this offense. And I just asked him where it came from, and he said, I got to tell you a story about this coach named Hal Mumme in a little tiny school called Iowa Wesleyan back in the 1980s. And that turned out to have actually transformed the game of football.
Hmm. And you say in the kind of the acknowledgement section of the book that as you learned about this coach that nobody had heard of named Hal Mumme, that one of the best things about his intriguing story was its very obscurity. I mean, here is this great story just waiting to be told by somebody like you.
True, and even today, you know, I mean, how many people really have heard of Hal Mumme? Inside the football world, coaches, commentators, former players, he is pretty well known. But to the average rank-and-file football fan, he's not. And, if you go back to there he is at this school in Iowa in 1989, a school with 450 students, possibly the worst football team in America when he takes it over. Absolutely. It's complete obscurity. And so when he and his assistant coach, Mike Leach, are driving around in the off season through the frozen wastes of the Midwest, looking, going to see people and looking for the secret of the forward pass, I just thought, that just sounds like a great story.
And I don't remember where it is in the book, but at one point you characterize Hal Mumme as a genius who irreverently destroyed and recreated the game of football. And that's a really interesting way to think about it, about somebody coming along and, in a sense, destroying the game, not permanently or irreparably, of course. But what is behind that choice of words?
So if you look at this, it's a game of football, and okay, it's offense that we're talking about here. But in fact, it's the product of all sorts of systems and ways of thinking about things. And you can really think of Hal, I do anyway, in the same way that you might think of one of those innovators like Jobs and Wozniak, inventing the Apple computer, or Hewlett and Packard, or people tinkering and being innovative and ingenious with, and indeed what they then do, their creations then do create enormous disruptive damage to traditional systems. If you look at what Hal's offense has done to football today, I mean, you turn on the TV and you're going to see some quarterback throwing the ball 49 times a game for 500 yards and 5 touchdowns. That's his offense. That didn't exist when he started. So he wreaked havoc on defenses all over the country, and he did it by doing things that no one had done before.
Hmm. So describe to our listeners where the book begins. I think it's quite effective. The first chapter is called The Mad Pirate's Revenge, and it's kind of interesting the way in which you just sort of plunge us into the new reality of football before then, in a sense, kind of explaining where this reality came from. So describe the dramatic game that is at the heart of this chapter.
Okay, so the book starts with 1 minute and 23 seconds to go in November of 2008. And the game being played is Texas Tech, which is sixth ranked, and had never been ranked that high before, or not recently anyway, and against University of Texas, number one ranked team, the best quarterback in the country at that point, Colt McCoy. And what I then describe is this incredible air raid offense that, you know, people were starting to get used to, but it had only seen for a few years, that has this ability to, you know, throw the ball 50 or 60 times and put up ungodly numbers of points and yardage on everybody, and no one could stop it. Well, we see this in action in the last minute of the game. And the final, and it's a very famous pass if you live in Texas, the final pass of the game is from Graham Harrell to Michael Crabtree, and a 30-yard pass and tiptoes into the end zone for the victory. And what I try to set up, as you say, is I try to set up, well, here's what this thing looks like. And then we sort of, and indeed, this is now swept through all levels of American football, high school, college in particular, NFL more and more. So I just go back to its origins and say, where did this guy get this idea? How did he implement this system? What was the process actually of transformation? How do you do that?
I think it's very intriguing, and I'm really glad that the second chapter of the book is here, titled A Job You Wouldn't Want. And you begin this chapter by saying, in the annals of the American workplace, there are few jobs as thankless, unforgiving, underpaid, overworked, lacking in security, destructive to marriages, and mercilessly competitive as coaching college football. Yes, there is the warm glow that comes from making an impact on the lives of impressionable young athletes, teaching them the virtues of courage, discipline, teamwork, etc. But for the dewy-eyed idealists and everyone else, the more immediate reality is this. And you go on to describe, in really rather brutal detail, all of the ways in which this kind of work can be really kind of soul-crushing. I'm so glad that's there, because, you know, it flies in the face of what we sometimes hear about, which is of big schools paying their football coaches gigantic sums of money that dwarf the money paid to, for instance, professors at that same university. But that is just one little sliver of the picture. And what you are describing, of course, is the unhappy reality for the vast majority of college football coaches out there. Tell us more about why you think that is such an important point to make in this book.
Well, it is. I mean, it's a tough sport. It's a tough job, you know, and it's high school coaching is really, football coaching is a really tough job too, except it lacks this one thing, which is the 24/7, 365 need to recruit all the time. And high schools generally don't do that. They basically take whoever lives in their district into their games. But college coaches, you know, the minute the game ends or the season ends, they're on a bus or a plane somewhere to go recruit, and sitting in the living rooms of countless players and guidance counselors and parents, and trying to convince people to come. It's a hard job. It's also thankless, because, as we all know, when the head coach gets fired, what happens to the assistant coaches? They all get fired. And I found myself in this world of, you know, people who often had 12 jobs in 20 years or even more. And it was tough. People moved around a lot. And when you look at someone like Mike Leach, who's now head coach at Washington State, you look at the hardship of those early years when he made $3,000 a year lived in these miserable, broken-down trailers. It is a very hard job to do. And so Hal, in my description of him, he's not only, you know, up against all of tradition of football, trying to build this offense that does mostly passes the ball in a world that only wants to run the ball, but he's also got to deal with just life as a coach, which involves, you know, he gets fired, he gets run out of town. It's a tough deal.
Well, and for him, it is also a reality that involves a wife and young children. So it's not just that he is subjecting himself to this because he loves the game of football so much and so desperately wants to coach it, but in a sense, he is taking along his wife and kids on this very difficult journey.
They're on the ride, and one of the things you hear and I write about is that, you know, when the typical thing happens, which is, you know, Thanksgiving comes around and the team hasn't done well and the head coach gets fired, and then of course all the assistant coaches get the news that they've been fired too. And often what happens is, you know, if somebody is able to find a new job somewhere, you know, typically the rules are you show up the next day and your family just has to worry about dealing with the problem itself, you know, or whenever anybody hires a coach, they don't really want to hear that the wife, you know, has got to sell the house or relocate the kids from school. And I just heard this from a bunch of coaches' wives. It's a very interesting world of really, I must say, really dedicated people, super, super dedicated people who run this game.
We're speaking with S.C. Gwynn, talking about his book, The Perfect Pass. And before we talk a little more about what Hal Mumme managed to develop, we should touch on the brief history of the game of football that you spell out. And I think the main reason that this is here is for us to have a better sense of sort of the entrenched reality against which this revolutionary-minded coach named Hal Mumme was going to try to work his innovative ideas. In brief, at least, just sort of describe the way in which football had a certain character right from the start, which, yeah, in a sense, was very inhospitable to the notion of throwing the ball, and particularly in terms of long forward passes.
Yeah, it goes back to the early days of football. I mean, football started with this kind of bloody scrum in the middle of the field that was just unbelievably violent. And the forward pass was introduced in 1906 mainly as a way to save the game. So many people were dying, you know, 18, 20, 30 people dying a year, 150 with serious life-threatening injuries. And so they introduced it. But the problem was that American football always wanted to regress back to that game. And to this day, it's still portions of it want to do that. So even though there were little explosions of offense, you know, Pop Warner in the Carlisle Indian School, or maybe Notre Dame with Newt Rockne a few years, Sammy Baugh at TCU, Norm Van Brocklin in the NFL with the LA Rams. Basically, football always reverted back to a heavily ground-dominated game. It was a running game. Football was something you did – I'm sorry, throwing was something you did on third down, you know, and really, and if you look at it, what it finally comes to in the mid-70s is what they call the dead ball era. In 1977, in the NFL, fewer points were scored than at any time since 1942. Fewer passes thrown since the 1950s. It was regressing again, and it was so bad that the NFL changed all the blocking rules to try to save the game again. But this is the era in which this new breed of people, you know, Mouse Davis in the run and shoot, Bill Walsh in the West Coast offense, you know, Hal Mumme, Lavelle Edwards in BYU, these really handful of people that I write about emerge from this kind of dead ball era with these hot new passing offenses.
Right. And I guess part of the point of your book is that some of these innovators are well known to football fans, but somebody like Hal Mumme is not. That is, in a sense, a chapter of this story that was largely untold until your book came along.
Yeah, and there's a lot that's untold in here. I mean, nobody's ever heard of Tiger Ellison. I mean, Tiger Ellison in the 1960s invented a type of offense at a high school in Ohio that uses a lot of the techniques that are the basis for all of the high-powered passing offenses now. And who's ever heard of Tiger Ellison? He had this crazy thing called the Lonesome Polecat. Nobody ever heard of, and yet the techniques, when I go through, you know, his offense was the run and shoot, which actually became very influential. But there's a lot of obscurity here. Very few people really know who Lavelle Edwards is. I mean, they might know his quarterbacks, Jim McMahon, Ty Detmer, Steve Young, but at BYU. But so much of this is rising out of obscurity, and even today, these guys are not household, you know, they're not like Vince Lombardi. Maybe they will be one day, but they're not now.
So in terms of of what Hal Mumme came to understand about the game of football and sort of its unrealized potential. I find it really intriguing that it was not just one single moment and a lightning bolt from the sky and suddenly I understand this new way of playing the game of football. You choose to describe it in this particular chapter as a series of four different epiphanies. And yeah. And these are epiphanies that unfolded over the course of years,
right.
and in different places and in different circumstances. Is this the way he sees it, or is this the way it made sense to you to frame it?
I don't think he ever saw it in terms of the four, although that's what it is. I mean, these came out of interviews with Hal. In fact, that's what it is. So there were four. One of them was really great, by the way. One of them, this guy is just good as a football coach. So he's the age 29, youngest offensive coordinator in the NCAA Division I. He's at University of Texas at El Paso, which is sort of the French Foreign Legion of college football. Terrible team. One of the worst in the game. They were playing against Brigham Young, BYU, who was the defending national champion, that had this super hot passing offense under Lavelle Edwards. And Hal, I think they were favored by 36 points or something like that, BYU was. Hal, because Hal was at UTEP, who was in the same division, he got to study their film. So he studied and studied and studied, and he tried to copy it. No one told him anything. It was like somebody who found a radio on the ground. You know, you pick it up and try to figure out how it works. And during this game, he unleashes BYU's own passing, this is 1985, passing attack against them, and beats them in one of the greatest upsets in college football history. And the other shoe dropping there is that BYU is so stunned that this guy has done this to them with their plays that they didn't even teach him, that they invite him up, and for years he spends time at the BYU camps, and he learns their system, which becomes the basis of his system. I mean, there's a lot of – I mean, that's what we talk about when we say these epiphanies. You know, that game was an epiphany, that he could do that to the nation's best football team.
Hmm. One thing that is a little difficult to understand about this story is how there could be various people along the way, like this coach out of Ohio, Glenn Tiger Ellison, who writes a book touting some of these revolutionary notions, a book that eventually Hal Mumme reads and is inspired by, but how these innovative thinkers would appear, and yet their innovations would not, in a sense, lead sort of inevitably to this innovation sort of sweeping over the game. And he's not the only one, of course. But so there are these sort of isolated pockets. But what is different about the story of Hal Mumme from some of those other earlier instances?
I think if I had to say what, that's a really good question. Let's look at Sammy Baugh, Dutch Meyer, coach of TCU in the Texas Christian University in the 30s. He had this quarterback named Sammy Baugh, who was maybe the best player who ever lived. And they ran a full spread offense. He ran from a shotgun. They used short ball control passes the way Bill Walsh later did. I mean, it was so far ahead of its time. So you would have thought, man, everybody's going to. But the fact is, hardly anybody did it. And so what was different about Hal? So one of the things that people thought about that offense was that, or most of these offenses, is they wouldn't be transferable. Not, you know, they wouldn't be transportable. That they would, you know, that somebody like Baugh couldn't be duplicated, or, you know, a receiver couldn't be duplicated. What Hal did, and this was maybe the biggest part of the revolution, was he designed an offense that could be run at the high school level easily. It was dead simple. The simplicity of the thing is most of the genius. It was just dead. So now you can see all over Texas where all of air raid offenses, all summer 7-on-7 air raid camps, the whole state's being swept by it. It's because you can teach it, because it's transferable. You can run it at junior colleges and small colleges, and you can run it anywhere you want to. And it was the, I think, if if a coach reads my book and takes anything from it, I would think he would take the simplicity. This guy designed a game that was really easy and simple for his players and really complicated and hard for your players.
And it also sounds like a system in which you did not necessarily need a spectacularly gifted quarterback or spectacularly gifted receivers in order for it to be implemented. I mean, you don't have to wait for an Aaron Rodgers to come along.
Exactly, and that's right. I should have said that. That you do not need that. And what it does is it makes, you know, if you look at that great book Moneyball, written a few years ago, what it was about this guy at Oakland who's got $19 million, and the New York Yankees have $190 million. And the problem is, how does the little guy in Oakland beat them? That's the problem. And the solution is how he uses statistics. In this case, Hal has these little guys, and how can they beat the big, strong, fast guys? Well, they can beat it through this system, a system that will allow a small quarterback or a receiver that isn't lightning fast to compete. So when you do it right, it levels the playing field, and there's a bit of David Goliath in it, with David and Goliath, which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. So a closing question. As we follow the exploits of Hal Mumme, one of the things that we sort of grapple to understand is why he's not more famous than he is. Why, if he ended up being such a brilliant innovator, why, in a sense, at least in the more conventional sense of the words, has his coaching career not been more successful, leading from one triumph to another?
Really, you can see the answer to that question, I think, at Kentucky. So he lights up the world at Iowa Wesleyan at the small college level. Then he goes to Division II, Valdosta State in Georgia, lights up the world, sets all the national records in NCAA D2. He's rewarded with the head coaching job in the SEC at Kentucky, 1997. And he takes his offense, and he beats Alabama and LSU. People said you could not use these video game passing offenses to win in the SEC. Hal did. Okay, now we're at the peak of his career. Unfortunately, what happens to him is he runs into a recruiting scandal at Kentucky. Not his fault. It was one of his coaches was out making cash payments to high school coaches and very bad things. It didn't prevent Hal from having to resign in the middle of it, even though he was 100% exonerated by the NCAA, but that was a year later. And I think you could say in a lot of ways his career took a turn at that point that it maybe is the main reason why he isn't the coach of the Green Bay Packers right now or something like that. There were some other problems later on, but Kentucky was really his glory and his undoing, unfortunately, for him.
Right. And, of course, we certainly get a sense through the pages of your book that the world of football, just in general, is not always particularly receptive to the ideas of a revolutionary thinker.
No, and it's also it's a razor-edge job, as we were talking about earlier. I mean, ask, you know, Colin Kaepernick and Les Miles about that, about how quickly things change. You know, Colin Kaepernick at the 49ers he was the second coming last year. Les Miles, a few years ago, was the greatest football genius in the country. They're guys that, you know, they're headed south real fast. So it's a cruel profession, I think. In addition to being, as you say, very unfriendly to people with new ideas who think they're going to throw the ball.
Right. Well, in the meantime, we get to know very much both the man and his intriguing revolutionary ideas, Hal Mumme, in this book, The Perfect Pass, American Genius, and the Reinvention of Football, published by Scribner and the author S.C. Gwynn. S.C. Gwynn, thank you so much for writing this great book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. This has been fun.
Greg, it has been fun. Thank you for such a careful read. It's great to talk to you.
And the time is 8:58 here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. And tomorrow on the morning show, it is the visit of Nan Calvert, our monthly visit to the morning show. And she has invited back to the program to join her Mabel Garrison. Mabel Garrison is renowned as one of the world's leading authorities on one of the most incredible creatures that lives on Earth, the dragonfly and the damselfly. And we're going to be finding out all kinds of things about this remarkable creature. On Monday's morning show, I'm going to be rerunning my interview with Barrett Goodman, writer, producer, and director of a really incredible American Experience documentary that is being rerun on PBS, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. It is a two-part documentary that explores the life and career of Bill Clinton. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at Carthage.com.